This is February 1st, Sunday, February 1st, and the title of my Dharma talk is Why Believe What You Think. Pretty good question. I sort of got onto this topic over the last couple of weeks because I've been doing a lot of fibrillating. Almost 2 weeks ago, I went into atrial fibrillation, which is something I seem to do two or three times a year, sort of a little ritual of mine. But unlike most of the other times, it didn't go away. And so I actually went for 9 days. And actually, it was I had a stress test 9 days in, and I got up on the treadmill to start it, and my resting heart rate was 140 beats a minute. And so they said, why don't you lie back down? And they went and found a doctor, and he came in and threw a prescription on my thing and said, you'll feel better if you take a beta blocker. And but he said, yeah, go ahead, take the stress test. So I got up there, and they were able to ratchet it up about 3 levels to where I was doing a brisk walk, and by that time I was up over 200, and they said, okay, that's probably enough, and laid me back down. So I went home, and after 9 days of trying to think my way into normal sinus rhythm, I just figured, well, it's just not going to happen. I'm going to have to take these drugs, and everything will get better then, maybe. And I sort of gave up and decided to have a coffee yogurt. And then I decided to have a chocolate brownie. And then just before I went to pick up the medication, it fixed itself. All of a sudden, I was back. And I can't tell you how happy I was. So, but a lot of stuff came out of that experience. The first was that I kept finding myself trying to will my heartbeat to be regular. I was trying to, it's just sort of a form of magical thinking. You know, here it is, some sort of electrical imbalance. I'm sure there's some connection to your mind state and levels of stress and whatnot, but believe me, after many, many years of trying, I've never been able to find any magic thought that will change it, but that doesn't seem to stop me from trying. And also noticed as time went on, I felt some frustration and even a little bit of depression. Just, you know, kind of bummed out. But then when I got into that and I had the insight to at least stop and say, okay, well, what's really going on here? And when I dropped all my concern about when is this finally going to end, what'll happen if I'm in fibrillation and I have to do Sangha entertainment night, how will I possibly be funny, or what'll happen when I do my Dharma talk, how will I possibly do that. When I dropped all that sort of thinking and just tried to take a look at what was really going on, there really wasn't a problem. You know, in the moment it wasn't painful. It was a little bumpy, a little fluttery maybe. But that was okay. You know, everything was still there. It really was just a problem of thinking, a problem of getting caught up in wanting things to be different. I've seen the same sort of thing when I worked in the hospital with patients who were in pain. You could have a patient who's rating their pain 10 out of 10, and it really is a big, big problem for them. And yet, all of a sudden the family member comes in, they get distracted, they're talking, maybe they're laughing, and you're standing off on the side seeing, wow, there right now, there is no problem. But of course, if you interrupted and said, could you rate your pain for me again, it's going to still be a 10 out of 10. So I guess the sort of the lesson to be learned is it's hard to have a problem without thinking about it. Our real problem is our thinking that something that cannot be changed should be changed. are thinking that things as they are right now should be different. How can things be different? How can things as they are right now possibly be different? Things as they are right now is reality. Not talking about how things will be tomorrow. You can daydream about that all you want, and maybe they will be different. But as things are as they are now, if you're anxious, if you're irritated, if you're bored, that's it. That's the way it is. I first sort of hit on this not terribly complicated insight, but I'm going to argue a really powerful insight. It really is life-changing to really get a hold of this and stop walking into the same wall over and over again. I first ran into this in Alcoholics Anonymous. Probably most people are familiar with the Serenity Prayer, which figures there quite a bit. I think the formulation is, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So, to accept the things I cannot change. For instance, First Noble Truth, life is suffering. That's it. Life is suffering. Anybody who takes a look at their day, at their life, moment for moment, is going to find things we don't like. It happens all the time. The question is, what do you do with that? It was in AA that I first ran into this concept of acceptance. There's a portion of the Big Book. If you go to a lot of AA meetings, you hear this quoted or referenced quite a number of times. It's page 449 of the Big Book for you 12-steppers. And I just want to quote briefly from it. This is the part of the Big Book where people sort of have their accounts. You know, here's what happened to me. Here's how I came to accept my alcoholism, and here's what happened once I did and once I started working the 12 steps. So this particular guy says, when I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. At this moment, right now. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. Of course, in Buddhism, we're not blessed with the God concept, so which actually should make it a little easier to understand that nothing happens by mistake. The poster girl for 100% acceptance is probably Byron Katie. Roshi gave a teisho on her. I just tell you a little bit about her. Got a lot of material. I'm probably going to fail to get it all in. But Byron Katie is this woman who lived out in Barstow, California, who spiraled down over the course of years into a more and more miserable existence. And she finally ended up in a treatment center for overeating because that was the only thing her insurance would pay for. And at some point while she was there, she just woke up. I won't get into telling the whole story, but suddenly she had some sort of awakening experience. And out of that came this realization that the problem is believing your thoughts. She when we first sort of, she sort of was a phenomenon that broke maybe a couple years ago. People around here started reading her book, and I was out in California at some point in the middle of a miserable situation, and my daughter texted me a quotation. Sasha texted me this quotation from her. She says, "Any stressful feeling is like a compassionate alarm clock that says you're caught in the dream." It's a wonderful way of looking at it, because our initial reaction to any stressful thought is, get me the hell out of this. You know, how do I make this bad, painful thought go away? To suddenly realize this is a marker. This is showing that somehow or other I'm not with the program. There's something I'm unwilling to accept. It's actually incredibly valuable, and it changes the way you live your life to actually welcome feeling anxiety, or welcome feeling fear, or boredom, or anger, because it suddenly gives you a chance to see, where do I have work to do? Now, with Byron Katie, the work that she does is to find that stressful thought, bring it up into consciousness. She even wants you to write it down on a piece of paper, and then ask four questions. So the first question to ask is this true? For instance, classic thought, my mother doesn't love me, my mother should love me. Okay, so number one, is it true? And the second question is, are you 100% sure that it's true? That's the point where most people say, okay, well, it's conceivable that my mother, as dysfunctional and bitchy and unsupportive and critical as she is, maybe somewhere, somehow, my mother loves me. But then the third and the fourth thoughts are the ones I really like. The third thought is, how does believing that thought make me feel? And this is just an opportunity to really sort of turn off the thinking machine and just go into the way it feels when you believe that thought, whatever it is. You know, if I don't wash my hands, I'll contaminate my family. If John doesn't shut up, I think I'm going to go nuts. Any thought, just to take it, and what does believing that thought make you feel like? Well, here's a good one. So-and-so should do better. They're not doing their job. They always do that. Why is she always butting her nose in into other people's business? You know, any thought like that that you keep bringing up, how does that thought make you feel? And then the fourth question is, what would I be like without that thought? It sounds awfully simple, but if you find something that really bites into you and take a look at it that way, sometimes it's pretty surprising how things can shift. The problem really isn't that we have these kinds of thoughts. It's pretty normal. Maybe some people are so advanced that they don't, but we do. And our problem comes when we buy into them. As Byron Katie says, you can have 10,000 thoughts a minute, and if you don't believe them, your heart remains at peace. It's one of the things people find when they begin practicing. They're often blindsided by how persistent and continual the thinking process is. One thought after another is grabbing our attention, and it seems like an insurmountable problem. You know, how on earth can I extinguish this flood of thoughts? What's happening, of course, is that we're simply becoming aware of a flood of thoughts that's been there in the background all the time, all our life, or at least since we began seeing ourselves as a separate person and trying to manipulate our environment. It's just this background noise that's going on, and it's really sort of our choice whether we pick up any particular thought and run with it, or whether we let it go. And what we do on the mat in this effort to concentrate on our practice, whatever it is, whether it's the breath or a koan, is to make this repeated choice between these thoughts which seem so important, which often have to do with us and our safety and our how we feel and how we hope things will come out and how much we regret the things we've done in the past, all of which seem so important and so believable, just to let it go, not to refute them. Although if there is a persistent thought that we can't get rid of, it is helpful to, not during Zazen probably, but at some point to sit down with it and do something like what Byron Katie recommends. But they're not a problem. The thoughts aren't a problem until we buy into them. It's the genius of our approach, is that it's okay to have stressful, deluded thoughts. They are compassionate alarm clocks. They show us where work needs to be done. The only way this can work is to accept them. Any thought that comes into the mind, we really don't control that. It's a common misconception to think that we choose the thoughts we think. We really don't. The thought comes in unbidden. We do have some choice about what we do with it once it comes in, but thoughts are really a product of what we've thought and dwelt on in the past. There's just sort of a karma, a momentum, and if you have a particular negative thought that you've thought a million times and you've bought into, it will come back. It'll come back again and again, and you can't make it stop in this moment. It is true that if you don't buy into it, if you, every time it comes, if you can treat it as a compassionate alarm clock or as a cloud moving through the sky, as a weather system, if it's connected with a strong feeling, sort of a weather system that's moving through, and let it go, it does extinguish. I know this from my own experience. There are thoughts that seemed intractable, you know, to me years ago, and I realize now those are gone. They don't happen anymore. But I didn't make them go away. There was no manipulation involved in their going away. Now I have new thoughts. You know, I've got a whole new set of problems. And that's okay. That's good. Like I say, Byron Katie is kind of 100% acceptance. It's almost kind of scary. She's willing to accept just about anything. And it almost seems inhuman. And I know some people wonder whether does she have feeling for other people, or it's all needless speculation, really. Our job is not to figure out who or what Byron Katie is. In her defense, I could say that Zen Master Lin Chi said something very similar when he said, "There is nothing I dislike." But it is a pretty amazing state when there is nothing that we can't accept. Most of us have a limit. Joko Beck, this Zen teacher who I think is still alive out in San Diego, really puts it a good way. She says, for everybody, there's a point you come to where you just can't accept it. And this is actually your point of practice. What happens to us in practice is the space, the things that we can let be, grows wider and wider. There's more and more that we can accept. physical pain that was just absolutely debilitating, suddenly it's okay, we can live with it. Anxiety that used to paralyze us, it can come up and we can move through it. But for everybody, there's a point where you just can't, and you fall back on whatever dysfunctional pattern you have to try to hold it at arm's length. And that's, she's really saying the same thing that Byron Katie says. That's the point at which we see what we have to work with. And often the way to get at it is to say, okay, when I feel this way, when this anxiety comes up, let's say when I'm sitting in front of the Doksan bell and my heart is beating, you know, way faster than I want it, what does it really feel like? You know, what's going on? Do I feel something in my stomach, in my chest? Is my neck tense? There's so many things where we sort of have this choice of, do I really sort of enter into what's actually going on, or do I look for my usual ways of escape? When something makes us angry, to find the space to feel the blood rising into your face, to feel your face flush, to feel your breath start to come a little faster and shorter, to feel that moment of sort of being carried away. If you can do that, suddenly you have a chance. You have an ability to step out of that automatic reaction where all of a sudden you're just totally focused on the injustice of what's being done to you and the glaring character defects of the person who's doing it. So, Byron Katie, Joko Beck, let's take a look at Anthony DeMello. I couldn't give a talk without at least thinking about him. For those who haven't heard before, DeMello was a Jesuit priest in India who worked a lot with Catholic lay people, and he gave a lot of seminars and talks, and he's just, let me just say, he's just a great guy. We'll leave it at that. Let me read what he says, though, here. This is during some sort of session with a bunch of people. He says, "Someone gave me two situations in which she found it difficult to be aware. She was in a service industry where many people were lined up, many phones were ringing, and she was alone, and there were distractions coming from a lot of uptight, angry people. She found it extremely difficult to maintain serenity and calm. The other situation was when she was driving in traffic with horns blowing and people shouting four-letter words. She asked me whether eventually that nervousness would dissipate and she could remain at peace." Then he says, "Do you pick up the attachment there? Peace. Her attachment to peace and calm. She was saying, 'Unless I'm peaceful, I won't be happy.' Did it ever occur to you that you could be happy in tension?" And then he repeats his little mantra, "Before enlightenment, I used to be depressed. After enlightenment, I continue to be depressed." You don't make a goal out of relaxation and sensitivity. Have you ever heard of people who get tense trying to relax? If one is tense, one simply observes one's tension. You will never understand yourself if you seek to change yourself." He says, how many hours are spent in Zazen trying to change your mind state? It's fool's gold. It's not the practice. The practice is not to get into some kind of mind state. Totally, totally a byproduct. Totally unlooked for. The harder you try to change yourself, the worse it gets. You are called upon to be aware. Get the feel of that jangling telephone. Get the feel of jarred nerves. get the sensation of the steering wheel in the car. In other words, come to reality and let tension or calmness take care of itself. As a matter of fact, you will have to let them take care of themselves because you'll be too preoccupied with getting in touch with reality. Step by step, let whatever happens happen. Real change will come when it is brought about not by your ego, but by reality. Awareness releases reality to change you. He says, in awareness you change, but you've got to experience it. At this point, you're just taking my word for it. This is so true. There's so much stuff out there, just great stuff. You know, Byron Katie, Eckhart Tolle, all these different gurus and teachers. And what they say is wonderful, but it has to be put into practice. You have to do it. I think it can be done, perhaps to some degree anyway, it can be done without ever crossing your legs and doing Zazen, but what an incredible help it is to have this practice, where there's nothing else to do but get in touch with reality. Our task, though, is to really do real Zazen, not to get sidetracked into this kind of mental manipulation, but to really dig in. He says, at this point you're just taking my word for it. Perhaps also you've got a plan to become aware. Or you could say you've got a plan to pay attention. Your ego in its own cunning way is trying to push you into awareness. Watch it. You'll meet with resistance and there will be trouble. When someone is anxious about being aware all the time, you can spot the mild anxiety. They want to be awake, to find out if they're really awake or not. That's part of asceticism, not awareness. It sounds strange in a culture where we've been trained to achieve goals, to get somewhere, but in fact, there's nowhere to go because you're there already. The Japanese have a nice way of putting it. The day you cease to travel, you will have arrived. Your attitude should be, I want to be aware, I want to be in touch with whatever and let whatever happens happen. If I'm awake, fine, and if I'm asleep, fine. The moment you make a goal out of it and attempt to get it, you're seeking ego glorification, ego promotion. You want the good feeling that you've made it. Does it strike home for anybody? Sounds like the first 30 years of my practice. We still got a little flavor of that going. When you do make it, you won't know. Your left hand won't know what your right hand is doing. And then he quotes, Lord, when did we do this? We had no awareness. This really is reminiscent of Zen Master Dogen, who said you get it when you're halfway there. If you find that you've gone all the way, keep going. Charity is never so lovely as when one has lost consciousness that one is practicing charity. You mean I helped you? I was enjoying myself. I was just doing my dance. It helped you. That's wonderful. Congratulations to you. No credit to me. So now I want to move on to one other sort of viewpoint, way of looking at this whole question of acceptance and what we do with our thoughts. And this is a form of therapy, a form of psychological therapy. Actually, Chris, my wife, got onto this and went out to Oregon, to a workshop in Oregon. It's called ACT, or ACT, and it's Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. This is really, just to give you a little background on this, this is part of what's called the third wave of cognitive behavioral therapy. And it includes the concept of, quote, radical acceptance. Radical acceptance, which I'll talk about in a moment, was credited to another kind of therapy in this third wave called dialectical behavioral therapy. This was sort of founded, the person behind this is a woman named Marcia Linehan, who, interestingly enough, credits her Zen Roshi, a guy named Pat Hawk, who's a Dharma heir of Aiken Roshi, with a lot of what she's putting forward. DBT, this dialectical behavioral therapy, has actually been shown to work with borderline personality disorders, which I've heard from more than one person are a patient population that no one wants to treat. And yet, she's actually had good success with people with this problem. It's pretty amazing. This whole third wave, even before the third wave, this whole business of cognitive behavioral therapy is really, there's a lot of evidence-based research that shows it works really well with problems such as intractable pain and debilitating anxiety. And there's also research that shows that ACT, ACT, works actually, I think the evidence may be a little thin, but there is some results that show this works even better. So there's really two parts to it. The first is acceptance, and the second is commitment. So acceptance is, as you probably know by now, that we feel how we feel. If we're anxious, we're anxious. And in this form of therapy, we don't try to focus on changing that. And that's a big switch from lots of kinds of psychological therapy. An awful lot of therapy is in this sort of goal-oriented mood of you have a problem, the problem is your bad feelings, and my job as a therapist is to help you not have those feelings. But this is a little more radical and says, okay, we're not going to focus on trying to change that. And then we have the second leg, which is commitment. And the client or the patient is encouraged to figure out what is actually important to him or her. If you can take the issue of how you feel right now off the table, what do you want to do? What do you value? And then finally, okay, do it. It's sort of reminiscent of a term intensive. We're in the middle of one right now. We commit to doing certain things, whether it's doing more Zazen. Sometimes it's something a little more hard to quantify, like not giving rise or not indulging in anger, working with one of the precepts, doing something that we've had trouble doing before, maybe something as simple as just getting ourselves to exercise. And the sort of genius of participating in a term intensive is that you make the commitment to do it, and suddenly something that you haven't managed to do for maybe for years, you can do. There's a power in making a commitment. Of course, especially if you make it with another person. If you tell somebody, here's what I'm committing to do, as human beings, that helps. It makes it a little easier. One of the values of working with a teacher is just to put yourself on the line with another human being. Give a good example of how ACT works with a simple client-therapist interaction, a little reframing. The client says, I want to change, but I am too anxious. And the therapist comes back with, you want to change, and you are anxious about it. Just a little tiny change. You say, but, she says, and. It gets you out of the trap of trying to focus on producing the right feeling. This is not our job. Our job is not to think courageous thoughts and then go perform courageous acts. A simple example is getting out of bed in the morning. I think I've used this before because this is a trap I fall into. I'll lay in bed and try to get myself to feel like getting up. But experience has shown that another really effective approach is to get up and then see how I feel. It works great. One of the wonderful things about being in training is you don't really have a choice. When I, in the morning I'm supposed to be here, and so the alarm goes off at 5 o'clock, and I can just get up. I have to admit, though, there are times when I spend 2 or 3 minutes trying to get into a better frame of mind first. But I'm learning. I'm teachable. This is really, what we're talking about here is really the Serenity Prayer put into action. Accepting the things I cannot change and changing the things that I can. One of the big, I couldn't possibly go into all the aspects of this particular kind of therapy, and my reading about it is pretty limited, so it would be embarrassing if I tried to, but there are a couple points that I really found helpful, and so I'd like to touch on them. There's some sort of hexagram or something, or and take a look at it. Yes, it's the ACT model of psychopathology. And there's 6 different points all radiating out from something called psychological inflexibility. And there's just 2 of them I'm going to talk about. So the first is called experiential avoidance. Or we could say avoidant behavior. When Chris went to this seminar or this workshop, the fellow who was leading it kept coming back to the image of a rabbit out in a field, eating whatever it likes to eat. Let's say it's a little lettuce. And here comes a lion. And so the rabbit wants to continue eating its lettuce, but it also doesn't want to be what the lion is eating. And so it zips down into its little hidey hole. And this is basically what's happening with us all the time. Something comes that looks like a lion, and we zip down our hidey hole. We feel panic, and so we do something to make that feeling go away. We feel anxiety, and there are a lot of different strategies to deal with this. Of course, to take us back to the beginning of this talk, is to drink. There are many, many people who, when they feel painful thoughts or feelings, turn to the bottle. In fact, a lot of people do it without even knowing that's why they're turning to the bottle. It's quite possible to do this all unconsciously, to have some sort of avoidant behavior. Maybe it's just staying in bed and sleeping, or maybe it's drinking, or maybe it's, here's another example, somebody begins to ask you questions that feel a little too intimate, starting to touch on something that's painful for you, and so an avoidant strategy could be to blow up at them, to get angry. Quite effective in the short term. You can destroy any threatening intimacy in a moment just by turning on the other person, and a lot of people do this. Most people probably have some area of their life where they've done this. We're that little rabbit, we see something threatening, and we duck down our hidey hole. The problem, actually, it was mentioned in one of the things I read, the problem is that these short-term strategies work. You can, if you drink, you can feel better. And actually, I remember when I was in recovery from drinking, thinking how fortunate I was that drinking ended up not working for me. Because there are people who drink all their lives. Heavy drinkers. Drinking is damaging the quality of their life, but they've got it together well enough that it's not going to get so bad that they have to stop. This is perhaps the biggest tragedy. To have some sort of dysfunctional strategy that works well enough that it gets you through the day and so you never drop it. For most people who come to practice and one part of our life or another, we've seen the need to go beyond that, to come to something deeper and more true. But we all have areas of our lives where we're getting by with half measures, something that's still inadequate. There's that saying, the good is the enemy of the best, or the good is the enemy of the great. DeMello said somewhere that he worked as a therapist, and he said as a therapist his job was to make his clients comfortable with their lives, and sometimes he felt quite conflicted about that. Maybe what's needed is to become extremely uncomfortable with your life. It reminds me of Roshi's a description of his mind state before he finally got through Mu. He just was sick and tired. To finally get sick and tired of half measures, of an inadequate response to life. To be able to clearly see, I'm letting myself go to sleep because I'm afraid of what is. To find some different way to go after that. Just to really, really get it that changing my mind state is not what it's about. Really think deeply about what is it I want. Here I am. I'm alive. I've got X number of years. I don't even know how many they are. I just know there's only so many. What do I want? And what can I do to help? Now, maybe if you say, well, I just want to feel good, so I'm going to pursue, these strategies. Well, good luck with that. The problem is, if you go to a strategy like, say, drinking or sleeping a lot, or looking for pleasure, it's limiting. It's constricting. Your life becomes smaller. You basically become inflexible. The wonderful thing about people who have made that commitment to practice is they're not willing to settle for second best. Sort of in this vein, Eiken Roshi said something about, said there are two ways of doing a sesshin, a Zen retreat. He says, one is to concentrate on survival, and the second is to focus on each moment as it comes up. Either way will get you through sesshin. But only the second way will give you an effective sesshin. If you focus on survival, then you will be disappointed after your sesshin because you will know that you have wasted your time just thinking about getting through it. I have to be frank and say I've had many, many sesshins like that. When I first went to sesshin, it was so painful. Just to get through was enough. And I found ways of doing it. You see that with old hands in sesshin all the time. They find a way to get through. But it's not always the way they really want to do it. It's not opening up. it's amazing to do what he recommends, which is forget about getting through it. Just focus on that one, that two, on that three. Here he's talking about people counting their breaths. That's all. Nothing else. Once we begin to do this, once we begin to say, it's okay, I just want to be here now, that becomes, suddenly we realize, yes, that actually works. It's amazing. I remember being in Sesshin and, you know, for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, holding my feet to the fire, staying with it, you know, not spinning off and thinking, how on earth can I possibly do this for 6 more days? Right away, of course, you can see the problem. What the hell am I doing thinking about 6 more days? I've lost it already. In this moment, there isn't a problem. All the problems are made by thinking. It's so liberating to realize that. Even physical pain, hard as it is to accept, the problem is wanting to get out of it. Your dog or your cat doesn't have that problem. Well, there's a second point in ACT therapy that I'm going to just leave off. Maybe I'll say a little bit about it. The second type of maladaptive behavior is called cognitive fusion. It's our habit of confusing our thoughts about reality with reality and directing our attention to the thoughts instead of reality itself. But to really talk about it takes more time than I have. So I think I'm just going to stop here, and if anybody has any comments or questions, fire away. Yeah, Paula.
At some point, I think I start to recognize what I'm good at, what my gifts are, and then I start to see what I'm not good at. So how do you make this leap into working on what you're not good at?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great place to start working. I guess my, I mean, give me an example. Tell me what you're not good at.
Well, if it's easy for me, if I know I'm good at giving a massage or a shiatsu, then I would continue that. But I'm not good at aerobic exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it hurts to breathe that
way.
Yeah. So how do you break that thought, believing that thought, that it's hard to do aerobic exercise?
Yeah. Well, the first place is aerobic exercise isn't necessarily for everyone. So you could have a breathing problem that could rule it out. But let's say you've thought it through and, you know, you've got a clear mind, you're an intelligent person in a lot of ways, and you decide, okay, this is something I want to do, then I hate to quote Nike, but the answer is do it.
Okay,
and
now that I've said that out loud, right, is that a commitment?
Yeah, I think you need to tell us.
We'll see what happens.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah.